Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. On today's show, I speak with Ryan Moccasin, Eric McCormick, and Brittany Bristow. That's all coming up on Endeavors. Well, hi there, happy weekend, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. Today, it's a triple threat featuring three different actors talking about three different projects. And my first guest is a pioneer in the indigenous comedy scene. He created kind of a sketch troupe called The Feather, which was recently adapted for television on APTN as The Feather News, which is a comedy show that parodies media and government from an indigenous perspective. He is the creator, executive producer, and also appears on camera. He is Ryan Moccasin, and I spoke with him a little while ago about The Feather News. This is me and Ryan Moccasin. Hey, Ryan, how's it going?
Fantastic, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. We got some not too bad weather over here, so we're surviving.
Right on, man. Where are you at?
Victoria.
Okay, cool. Yeah, it's, man, it's been surprisingly springtime here in middle Saskatchewan. It's like plus one right now. It's weird.
It's warm for this time of year, huh?
It is, man. It's really weird, but I'll take it. But yeah, things are good. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, speaking of weather and things news related, The Feather News comes out tomorrow, and I know you're one of the producers on this project. Where did the idea come from for a Indigenous sketch show?
Yeah, so that was my idea. I'll take full responsibility for it. It started in 2018. I started it in May of that year. I really want to explore the area of Indigenous satire, especially when it comes to news, because there wasn't really that much, to be honest, in that area of people doing that. There was, and still is, Walking Eagle News by Tim Fontaine. He still puts out articles and funny material, and that's pretty much it. So I really want to just have fun with how Indigenous people were represented in the news. And so I started The Feather, which started as a comedy blog in 2018, and started putting out fake news articles that dealt with Indigenous content and humor as well, mainly. And then a few months later, I met up with some stand-up comedians to help me start doing videos, and that snowballed one thing after another. We picked up another team member, Muscula Raw. He's our editor, and then the two people who host the show is Sean Cuthan and Danny Knight, and we are all stand-up comedians except Muscula. He's got a musical background. So us four core members are kind of the thrust behind The Feather News, and yeah, it just snowballed into what we see today. So that's how it started 5 years ago.
You know, when you look at sort of indigenous film and how indigenous people are portrayed in Canadian media, whether through their own films or others, it's usually either in drama or in horror. You don't see a lot of comedy necessarily. Yeah. Why do you think that is? Why haven't we gotten there yet?
Yeah, I had somebody asked me this question a while ago. They asked me why are the stories we tell nowadays like so dystopian, you know, or as you said, based in horror and drama as well. And I told, and my answer to that is because the past is so dystopian to us, you know, as Indigenous people. You know, we have a lot of stories connected to tragedies, which is there's no shortage of when it comes to Indigenous communities all across Canada and Canadians in general. You know, there's no shortage of tragedies, atrocities, you know, as you see in the news today when it comes to residential schools. There's still uncovering things about those, you know, stories that collect that connect us all. So that's where we kind of dive into when we get the drama and the horror, you know, how we portray those stories. But when it comes to comedy, there's a simple equation in comedy. It's tragedy plus time equals comedy. You probably hear that, you know, ad nauseum from comedians around the industry. But, you know, enough time needs to pass before we can talk about these tragedies. And we do this in a way where we can kind of bring light to the situation so people know about it, but also in a way we can heal ourselves and heal the community around us by, you know, laughing, you know, just laughing. And so it's kind of like a healing method and a way to connect with other people so we can have these conversations. So
people say that Canadian comics have a very sort of, you know, distinct sense of humor. Is there something that you think is typical of an Indigenous comedic way?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak for myself. I can't really speak for other comics, but I know that my writing is really roots itself in between race relations between Indigenous people and non-Indigenous people. Could be, you know, non-white people as well, you know, how those dynamics work and how that interplay happens between race relations and race groups, you know. And so that's really what I like to have fun with, you know, because, you know, we all like to say Canada is this multicultural nation. It's a melting pot. And it is, you know, there's so many people here and it's getting different and different every day. And I like to have fun with that, you know, like how would it look, you know, for example, you know, how, like in the show, we in the Feather News show, one of our episodes, we have fun with how would an Indigenous treaty signing look, you know, if reimagined, if today, you know, so we kind of have fun with that. And when it comes to Canadian comedy as well, I know for myself on the prairies here, I mean, it's just like we live like in a cold dungeon, a cold freezer for 6 months out of the year. It's quite depressing. So, you know, so in the wintertime is really where I buckle down. I do more writing and, you know, just start expressing myself so I don't get too entirely depressed by living in a, you know, a cold dungeon for 6 months out of the year. So it could do something with that, you know, living in a freezer, living in the Arctic, you know, other than in the tropics. So, you're exactly right. Our comedy is quite different than others, but it's fun to have.
You mentioned race relations, and in the beginning of the first episode, you mentioned both Michelle Latimer and Joseph Boyden, who are two people that whose Indigenous identity has come under question, and we're seeing that a lot with others like Mary Ellen Taparo-Lafon. What do you make of stories that we like that we hear, and how much is enough for one person to claim Indigenous identity, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it's first of all, those episodes are fun to do to have fun with all that, and I can tell you our experience. You probably recall at the start of that episode, we actually had to have our indigeneity notarized. So before us four key creatives could start working on the show for APTN, we actually had to go to a commissioner, a representative of the government, to sign his legal document to say, okay, yeah, these guys are Indigenous, you know, which is funny because we never really had to present our status cards or any other paperwork. We just had to go in front of a legal representative and say, you know, this is for sure. It was kind of a weird process. So just to give you a background on what we had to do to prove how Indigenous we were. But when it comes to individuals who want to claim indigeneity and it becomes questioned later on, I would, you know, they're claiming they're from this community, right? Well, then let's go to that community, right? What do they have to say? And more often than not, that community is questioning, like, we don't know what they're talking about, kind of thing. And that's where that confirmation comes from, right? So we just have to listen to the home communities, and because they know best. But there is going to be a time down the road where we're all going to have a little bit of indigenous in us, you know, because that's just, you know, that melting pot, that multicultural aspect, right? So it becomes a question on, you know, is 1% or 2% good enough to claim that you're indigenous, right? You know, is your 12th generation back good enough, right? And that's a conversation we're going to have, I think, more seriously, you know. And of course, there's questions of, you know, the Indian Act, right? When is that going to get updated? You know, I think that's maybe when we have to have a conversation. Do we want to get rid of the Indian Act, replace it with someone else, replace it with something else? And then what kind of identity or what confirmation of identity do we need, like document wise, community wise? But I think it starts at the community level and getting rid of that damn Indian Act, man. So,
you know, this is fundamentally a comedy show, and comedy's undergone a lot of scrutiny, I think, over the last couple of years with, you know, things people are saying, you know, being reevaluated in certain contexts, whether you want to call it cancel culture or accountability culture. Mm-hmm. As a comedian, where do you stand on that conversation that's happening?
Yeah, I get, I watch the conversation, the cultural conversation we have around that. And my experience with it is, like, comedians, we love to talk about cancel culture more than anybody else. You know, you'll see it. That just seems to be like a radioactive word we like to use to, you know, generate headlines, generate buzz and stuff like that. But my understanding, personal understanding of it, is that you shouldn't be afraid of getting canceled if you're talented enough. You know, if you're a good comedian, if you understand the writing process, if you understand your subject matter, and you're informed of the issues you're talking about, and then you make smart jokes about it, you shouldn't be concerned about getting canceled, right? That's the approach we took with this show, is we actually hired research producers who have academic backgrounds to, for instance, research subjects about the RCMP or economy on reserves, just so us as writers, so that's what we did before we actually started writing the show, is we got our research producers to look at the, because every episode has an underlying theme to it all. So we had the research producers answer these research questions. And then we dove into that before we actually dove into the writing process, because that would make us more informed. Because let's face it, we're talking about sensitive subject material, right? So we want to do it in a respectful manner. So our writing team, which is us four, we want to write jokes about it, but we also wanted to learn a thing or two, right? Because we don't know everything as writers. So we got these academic people to help us understand these subjects better. And so we learned a lot while writing this. And so that's my, I guess, takeaway with this question in cancel culture. You can joke about anything, but if you do it in a respectful and you're well-informed and you're talented, you shouldn't have anything to worry about if you're going to get canceled. So that's just my own personal opinion on it.
So for you, would you say that there is any subject that's off limit? Like, are there some things you're just like, I don't feel comfortable going there?
There is, actually. Yeah, there's, we had a conversation with APTN about this, because they had to approve our scripts, right? We never had that before, because we were our own editorial authority when we were just a YouTube show. So when we switched over to working with APTN, they had to sign off on the scripts. And they were great to work with. I was surprised that they let us get away with what we did on this show. But there were some things that they told us to pull back from, you know, when it comes to residential schools, because this was at a time where all that news was coming out of them finding bodies in the ground. And So that kind of stuff, which is fresh in our minds, you know, don't joke about that, right? Because that's near and dear to everybody's hearts, right? So, you know, joking and like being joking about things, tragedies as they happen, you know, that's just like a no-no, right? Because that's fresh in everybody's mind. So that's the one thing I would say. But yeah, APTN was there to kind of like, you know, guide us through that process because they know what good programming is and they know what when it's going too far. So it was good to have them to help us guide the process. And so, yeah, I would say there are like, you know, you don't insult people who are victims of tragedies as it happened and stuff like that. So and nothing malicious and never punch, like don't really punch down and stuff like that. So
it feels like APTN is, I mean, it's been around for a while, but it's definitely, I think, becoming more integrated into the quote unquote mainstream, if you want to talk about, you know, phrase it like that. And we're seeing, you know, CBC have some more Indigenous led or Indigenous centric shows. As an Indigenous performer, how do you feel about where Indigenous culture and Indigenous filmmaking and storytelling is in the context of the greater media and how that's portrayed?
Yeah, I mean, I love talking about like how like our representation in media, you know, we were pretty much shut out of it historically, right? Back in like the 1900s and early 2000s. So it's kind of great seeing this renaissance of Indigenous representation down south. You have Reservation Dogs, which is doing amazing right now. They had Rutherford Falls, which unfortunately, I don't know why they didn't renew it. It was an amazing show. And yeah, we have, you know, some new shows coming on CBC. They're really pushing for that. And so you're just seeing all these, you know, Indigenous artists and performers, you know, getting their stories told and heard. And it's really good to see that. And myself, like as a producer in this industry, it's good to see. I mean, I want to see more Indigenous people behind the camera, you know, not just in front of it, you know, people who have their own production companies, Indigenous owned production companies that work with these bigger streamers like Netflix, APTN and CBC, right? Indigenous writers, Indigenous camera people, you know, all the cast, I mean, all the crew members, Indigenous, you know, so we need to see kind of that industry more represented with Indigenous voices, you know, because that could translate to see what you in front of, to what you see in front of the camera. And even with these streamers, or these companies, of course, APTN, majority Indigenous, but CBC, maybe we could see some Indigenous people in the boardrooms, right? More executives calling the shots on which shows get greenlighted. So, and but yeah, so that's what I would love to see more is Indigenous representation behind the camera. And I think we can go a lot further.
Oral traditions, I think, are a huge part of Indigenous culture. Is that why they're Indigenous people are such good storytellers, because there is that, because that's like there are no, you know, for years nothing was written down. It was all just, you know, folk tales and word of mouth.
Absolutely, yeah. A big part of storytelling and comedy, the two, the more I do this, the more interconnectedness I see is that comedy is all about timing, right? You know, how do you like how you time your jokes, how do you even like place your words and stuff like that, how you construct your sentences and paragraphs to construct a perfect joke, right? It's all about timing. That's the fundamental aspect of writing it. And that comes from storytelling as well, how you engage your audience. It's why most of our elders are master storytellers, right? Because they understand that timing and also how you feed off your audience, right? It's a very performative art, storytelling. You know, you're not speaking to your audience, you're speaking with your audience. They're part of the performance with you. So to see them master their craft and then you apply that to comedy, I think it's just an easy transition, right? And our elders are funny as well, right? They can tell funny anecdotes in their stories as well to keep the audience engaged. So there's the parallels I see between comedy and storytelling, which, as you say, yeah, we have a strong oral history here as Indigenous people, and that translates well to the stand-up stage. So, yeah.
Was there a favorite moment or a favorite skit that you have from filming the Feather News?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a sketch where we wrote everything at the top of 2021, January 2021, so about over a year ago. And one of the sketches we wrote, we wanted to write a sketch about the Pope coming to Canada and us scoring an interview with him, right? And we put him in like a Maury kind of style interview, Jerry Springer, where we face him up against Indigenous people, right? And we ask him questions. It's like this like talk show kind of thing, right? And so we wrote that sketch and we filmed it over the summer. It went great. It's hilarious. I can't wait for people to see it, but we do it in a respectful manner, right? So we kind of ask hard-hitting questions to the Pope. And so I was a producer on the show, but I'm also kind of like the gopher because we don't have a big budget. Our costume designer, his name is Jeff Chief. He designed these amazing costumes, and sometimes he can actually attain the actual costume. So he knew a priest. I forget which church, but he knew a priest, and still does. And he actually confirmed that he could use the actual costume from a priest, right? So it was up to me to go to this priest's house and take away a priest's robe from him, for our show. So I never thought I would be doing that as an Indigenous person. I think I could be the only one to say in Canada that I got to take a costume away from a priest for one of our sketches. And as an added bonus, we didn't know at the time that who's the Pope? What's his name again? I
Oh,
forget.
Francis.
Yeah, at the time we didn't know that Pope Francis would actually come to Canada later on in the year, apologize for what they did, and even call things a genocide. And we had no idea. But so it's kind of like satire becoming truth, right? So I think it's going to be a fun sketch. But yeah, just funny things like that happen in the background, and I can't wait for people to see that one.
And finally, is there something you want audiences, and maybe particularly non-Indigenous audiences, if they may watch it, to take away from a show like this?
Yeah, it's mainly, we want people to laugh about it, right? Because it's at its core, it's a comedy show. And in the past, we actually had people believe some of our articles were real. And so we kind of get people in on the joke. So yeah, we want people to laugh, but we also want people, to walk away with a few nuggets about truth, about us. And we also want people to understand how it is to be Indigenous in Canada, which is what we do with the show. We try to share the Indigenous experience in Canada through comedy and satire. So if you can laugh, maybe you can learn a thing or two. But yeah, those are the main two things.
Well, the show is The Feather News, and it premieres February 14th on EPTN. Ryan Moxon, thank you so much today.
You betcha. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Cheers. Well, that was my conversation with Indigenous comedian Ryan Moccasin. He's the creator and executive producer of the new sketch show, The Feather News, which premiered February 14th on EPTN. Well, you may know my next guest for his hit role on the groundbreaking television series Will and Grace. But since then, he has also appeared in a variety of other projects, including Perception, Travelers, and even a recurring role in Atypical, as well as the films Immigrants and The Architect. He's in a hilarious new film that is set in, of all places, Penticton, British Columbia. He is Eric McCormick, and I spoke with him not too long ago.
Eric McCormick, how are you today?
I'm good, man. How about you?
I'm good. I'm good. Yeah. We're starting to warm up here a little bit. It's nice.
Oh, yes. It's actually, believe it or not, I know it sounds ridiculous to complain, but even in Los Angeles at the moment, I was in a winter coat this morning walking the dog. It's cool everywhere.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Well, the film Drinkwater doesn't take place in L.A., but it does take place in Penticton. I think it's the first film I've ever seen that is set in Penticton. Was that a draw for you?
Well, weirdly, yes. For the pandemic had been on for like 6 months. We put on a pandemic. going on for about 6 months. I was dying to work, dying to get somewhere, and to shoot in a small town in Canada that had very few cases. So it was very, and a lot of it takes place outdoors, very freeing. The idea that it was as Canadian as it is, that it's unapologetically so, the subject matter, the dialogue, and the location was exciting. I'm based in Vancouver when I'm not in LA, so to be anywhere in BC was great. But also, my wife's family comes from that area, and she spent her youth, her summers in Penticton. Turns out, not only in Penticton, her grandparents' house was right across the street from the house that my character would be used for the first week of filming. So there's a lot of connections to Penticton, and it looks so, I think it's a love letter to the town. People are going to want to go there when they see the movie.
You mentioned distinctly Canadian, and I'm curious, you know, as someone who has worked in both the US and Canada and being from this country, do you find that we have a distinct sense of humor in our art?
Well, I mean, the word that comes up all the time is self-deprecating. I think what makes Canadian humor so Canadian is that we take the piss out of ourselves all the time, and always have, from SCTV through Kids in the Hall. We know when Americans make jokes about us, jokes about A or Tim Hortons or poutine, it's like, dudes, we know, we already make those jokes ourselves. We own our own identity. I just think it's taken a while for us to own it as much as we do now. I've always said it started for me with Canadian music. Canadian music just exploded in the 70s and the 80s. Canadian television started to come along in the 90s. But Canadian film, it's hard to get Canadians to walk down Snowy Street to see a Canadian film at the theaters. But this film, when we showed this on big screens during the various festivals that we went to, it was just amazing, particularly because of the very Canadian soundtrack. It was amazing to see people enjoy their country on a big screen and know that this movie is for them.
On the self-deprecating part, there's a couple of times in the film where your character Hank is dressed a little bit maybe over the top in some aspects, and there definitely is an art to looking ridiculous. How much of that was you, and how much of that was Steve, and how much of that was the costume designer?
Well, the one weird part, because Hank feigns disability when he's clearly quite abled in order to get his disability checks. He's so able that when we first meet him, he's on a spin bike at home, and he's dressed in these very tight bicycling outfits. That was it, definitely in the script. And I thought, this is going to be a tough character to establish for an audience, because he looks just fine. But then when you finally see him in the second scene, strap on a leg brace and a neck brace, and then get into a scooter to go down the street, you realize what a great big liar he is. And by then he's wearing much more sort of frumpy small town clothes.
You know, he's an interesting character because he feigns disability, and he's clearly, you know, got some sense of paranoia, maybe a little bit of a conspiracy theorist, and that's something that we saw increase a lot during the pandemic, is people having all sorts of ideas about what is and isn't reality. How did you approach that aspect of it, and why do you think certain people go there in terms of their perception of things?
Well, I think people go there because they have less and less influence from the world. Shut-ins, people living in their mother's basement. But sadly, the thing that was supposed to open all of that up, the internet, has made it worse. I think that's the biggest problem right now, is that this social media in particular that is supposed to give us all points of view is in fact been targeted to our exact fears and paranoias. And that's why I think it's become worse. And I think that that's, I did think about that as we were shooting the movie. We don't make reference to COVID or anything, but he is definitely someone that is paranoid because he doesn't want to get caught doing what he's doing. He's living a lie. He lost his wife to clearly just being a bit of an asshole and being not being husband material. And he's about to lose his son for the same reason if he doesn't snap out of it. So the one of the many endings of the film is just that realization that he has got to stop hiding behind his fears and his lies and come out and greet the world. And that's one of my favorite moments in the movie.
When we get sort of too reliant on a routine, whether it's, you know, what Hank goes through, you know, that he's just perpetuating his disability, is complacency the enemy in that situation?
I think the, you know, a quote I use all the time is from A Christmas Carol, when the ghost of Christmas Present opens his robe and there's two children there. And he says, "The boy is ignorance, the girl is want. Beware them both, but most of all, beware this boy." I think, particularly in the States, where I've been for some time, ignorance is the biggest problem. And the second biggest problem is that those of us who aren't ignorant and can see the ignorance of others and can, we do get complacent. Yeah, we figure, okay, I'm tired of fighting City Hall. I'm tired of trying to convince red states that that have a woman's right to choose. So we fight, and yes, if we get complacent, that's when it's all going to fall apart.
You mentioned red states, and there's a great note that your character has when Mike talks about him, you know, wanting to go to university, and he's just like, do you want to Hank says something like, "Do you want to perpetuate the socialist agenda?"
Yes.
Why do you think so many people of Hank's ilk, whether it's small town or those who you know, maybe see the world a little differently, can be so wary of education?
First of all, if you don't have it, you're afraid of it. You're afraid of somebody being smarter than you are, or having access to things that you don't have access to. So I think there's something protectionist that happens. That I always think of it as that John Cougar Mellencamp song, where he's like, you know, "I was born in a small town. I'll probably die in a small town. Got no time for the people in the big town." I thought, Jesus, people, there's a lot of other things outside that small town. And the just what used to be kind of folksy and is now become incredibly protectionist and incredibly, certainly down here, aggressive. They aggressively don't want to know from the liberal agenda, or they don't want to know from the intelligentsia. And it's terrifying. It's terrifying to think that not being educated is better than being educated. Can't fathom it.
Hank and Mike sort of have a bit of a tense relationship, at least in the early part of the film. But how does that affect you when you work with actors? What was your relationship with Daniel like?
Well, first of all, he's amazing. Daniel Doheny is the star of this movie. He is so great. He's like a young Jim Carrey. He's got so much heart and invention. Stephen Campanelli, the director, gave Daniel and I a lot of room to play in that first week, which was all the stuff between him and I at the house. And he was supposed to be playing an 18-year-old at the time, and that's how old my son was at the time we shot this. So I brought a lot of my fatherly instincts, and I'm the oldest guy on set these days, almost always. So I love working with younger actors so that I can bring whatever influence can help, but also so that I can learn from them. I love, they remind me of the balls I had at that age and the fearlessness. And I want to share in that. And I think particularly playing father and son, and realizing if Hank doesn't change, he's going to be a very bad influence on his kid. And every parent fears that. And around that age, just as my kid was looking at colleges, I wanted to make sure I was only helpful, because it would be very easy to not.
You mentioned you were given a lot of room to play. It feels like in a script like this that it's ripe for some improv. And I know you have a background. Was that something that you were able to do at all? Like, was there any part that was improvised?
A lot. And I don't mean to take away from our writers at all, Ted and Luke, but there was just, particularly between he and I, between Daniel and I, there was, and Stephen just loves that. He just loves to laugh. He wants to be surprised. So he would just say, do that, whatever you want on that line. And I've seen the movie now 4 or 5 times. And every time I'm like, wow, there is a lot of it that we just made up. there's a bit where I come out to wave to the kids next door. And I, just before I was put to exit onto the balcony and wave down to them, I took off all my clothes and I just got down to my tidy whities, and that surprised him. And then I waved to her and I called her by the wrong name with a lot of bravado. Her name is Wallace, but I say, hey, Wendy, no reason, just to make Stephen laugh. And all that stuff stayed in the movie. And a lot of what Daniel does, he's making up on the fly. And I think that's what gives it, it feels very alive. It feels, it doesn't feel like it's self-congratulatory, because it's very on the fly.
What, you know, it's funny you mentioned that tidy whitey scene, and we were talking about sort of self-deprecation and ridiculousness earlier. Why are tidy whitey so funny?
I don't think they're flattering on most men. There's some guys where anything would be flattering on them. I've come to believe that the boxer brief is just more flattering to a man.
Are there any favorite moments or maybe a favorite scene from the movie that you really enjoyed filming?
Yeah, for sure. There's a scene where it's sort of we've met Hank. We've seen Hank with Daniel's character, Mike, but we haven't truly seen them in the world. I'm called to the principal's office, and this is the first time we see me in a scooter, which Hank does not need. It's just part of his elaborate ruse. But my mother-in-law in real life has ridden a scooter for 15 years. She has MS. So I have watched her smash into walls and just drive that thing like a maniac. And I thought, that's what has to happen. So we didn't really sketch it. I just said to Steve, can I hit a few things in here? And he said, whatever you want. I hit the door frame and I smash into the principal's desk. And I have this great, ridiculous speech that you first realize exactly, not just how paranoid Hank is, but that his paranoia doesn't even make sense. He's just invented his own conspiracy theory that is nuts.
Well, the film is Drink Water, and I believe it premieres on the 17th on Amazon Prime Video.
Yes, I'm very excited about them picking it up, because I was afraid that this movie would die in the theaters. And it's like, no, people have got to see it. They've got to enjoy this at home. It's a family film. It's really fun, and some of the best Canadian soundtrack you'll ever hear.
And definitely some of the best dialogue I've heard in a while, I think. I think that's what's really funny is, you know, the characters are their own thing, but it's really the dialogue that makes it, I think.
I agree. And some of the stuff between he and I, the grocery store where I want to buy chocolate milk, and he says, you're lactose intolerant. And I said, I'm working on my tolerance. Lines like that, I just love.
Yeah. Eric McCormick, thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Dan. I really appreciate it.
All right, you have a good day now.
You too.
Bye-bye.
That was my interview with actor Eric McCormick. His new film, Drinkwater, is out now on Amazon Prime Video. My final guest today is actress Brittany Bristow, and she's in a very interesting film called Shadowtown. It takes place in Iceland, and Brittany is one of the few non-Icelandic actors in the project, although her dad's family is Icelandic. We talked about Iceland, the horror genre, how her involvement in this project goes back many, many years, working with John Rhys Davies, and we even talked about one of my favorite films of all time, Let the Right One In. This is my conversation with Brittany Bristow.
Brittany Bristow, hello, good morning, or good afternoon for you, I should say.
Good day.
Yes, it's already midday for you.
Yes, it doesn't feel like it, let me tell you.
And I understand you're right in the middle of shooting too, so.
Yes, I am. We're 1 week out from finishing, and we've been on night shoots, so I feel like a zombie. It feels like first thing in the morning for me too, so we're in this together.
What's it like shooting in St. John's?
It's so great. I mean, it's very snowy right now. We had a massive snowstorm, so it was a bit of a beautiful mess for a minute, but it's been really fun.
So, you have this new film, Shadowtown, coming out, and I'm fascinated because it's you, John Rhys Davies, and then a cast of people, or a cast of actors from Iceland.
Yes.
How did this project fall into your lap?
Well, I actually got involved with the project when I was my late teens, early 20s. I'd met Jan a handful of times, and he'd known of me. I'm Icelandic on my dad's side. So there's an Icelandic community in Canada that sort of has these little meeting times, and we all, you know, get pan a cooker and do all these little things. And I used to go to them when I was little. And I've been to Gimli a handful of times, which, for people who don't know, is actually the largest settlement of Icelanders outside of Iceland, is in Gimli, Manitoba, of all places. Like, they could have chosen a warmer place, but there was a beach. So, so I'd met Jan a handful of times, and he approached me with the project years and years and years before we actually started shooting. So I was sort of involved right from the get-go when he decided that this was something he wanted to start working on. And I got to live through all of the iterations, and from you know, page one of script one to whatever draft we ended up on, I was sort of a part of the whole process, which was really cool.
And speaking of Gimli, your co-star in the film played Gimli, John Rhys Davies.
That's such a good segue.
Right?
I didn't even think of that, but like, kudos to you, because that was brilliant.
who is a legend in his own right.
Big time.
How was that going toe-to-toe with him?
It was amazing. I love John. We've worked together 4 or 5 times now. I keep saying 4 or 5 because I genuinely can't remember, but I think it's 5. We worked together for the first time 12 years ago, and that was an absolutely terrifying experience for me, like in the best way possible, because he is just such an incredible force to be reckoned with, but just the most generous and kind and open actor. He wanted to do everything he could to lift me up then, and that's still true today. Working with him on this was really fun because we had that comfort. We were able to be a little bit playful in those moments, and there wasn't any intimidation, which was incredible. I never thought I would be at a point where I would say confidently that I am not intimidated by Gimli and or Salah and or every other amazing role he's ever played in the history of film. But he was my comfort when we were there in a lot of ways.
Are you excited to see he's returning as Salah after something like 40 years? Are you excited?
I cannot even begin to express how excited I am for that. Like when I heard about it, I emailed him and I was like, John, is this for real? It's like, yes. Can't handle this right now. I'm going to turn into a fangirl all over again. I'm never going to be able to speak to you again.
So. You know, it's interesting. Horror has definitely undergone a bit of a resurgence, I think, in the last decade or so.
Yeah.
And yet, it is still a rite of passage for filmmakers, whether they're a director or whether they're in front of the camera.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is? Why has horror sort of become this jumping off point for a lot of careers?
You know, I think it's something that horror fascinates everybody, whether you enjoy it or not. I think it's something that's fascinating to every person because it terrifies us. And some of us love that feeling and some of us can't stand it. And I think it's something that there are different levels of horror for everyone and different things scare everybody. And so I think it's one of those things that to embody that fear, it requires a certain willingness to lose yourself in it. Because like with any emotion, you know, you can fake laugh, you can fake scream, but to actually have that emotion come through and resonate with people while they're watching, you have to be willing to really dive in. And you have to be willing to work with the people around you to create scenarios that fascinate. And I think what we really tried to do in this film was explore what that fear looks like internally. Rather than show it with jump scares and rather than do all those things. And I think that there's so many facets by which people can explore fear and horror, whether it's a psychological thriller, suspense, actual like gory horror. It's, you know, I think it's one of those things where we have the ability to sort of explore all of it. So I think when somebody does it really well, it is something it's noticeable because it stays with you. And I think because you experience that fear through other people, it becomes almost a fear within ourselves, or like we become sort of fascinated by those things. You know, you look at all of the Halloween movies and Scream movies and like, are those franchises ever going to go away? Probably not, because people are fascinated by the fear and fascinated by the story. And some people find them cheesy and some people are absolutely terrified. And now it's their biggest fear. And I think horror stays with us in a really profound way, because every single person on the planet is afraid of something. Yeah.
Do you have a favorite horror film?
I love a lot of horror films. I prefer the psychological thriller horror side of things. I remember seeing Seven. That movie is wild. I love that movie. I think for me, I really love psychological thrillers and ones that have just like a, they're complex. They're not jumpy, but they're well developed, and the world within which you're living feels real. I don't know what that says about me, but I like those ones.
You know, it's interesting as our sort of knowledge of film expands and we see all these streamers, we get exposed to more international films. And I think Scandinavia and the Nordic countries in particular, there's a lot of unheralded film greatness that comes out of those countries like Sweden, Denmark, Iceland. What do you like about that style of cinema that's prevalent over there?
Yeah, I think I've always been really fascinated with subgenres of noir. And I think Scandinavian noir is like a really a really unique genre. I don't know if anybody would call it its own genre, but for me, it's like the Nordic noir. It is this sort of cold cinema. It feels a little hollow, but not in like a, not in a bad way, not in that something's missing. It's like you feel hollow in yourself while you're watching it, because I think the Nordic countries and, you know, Scandinavia in and of itself, it has this sort of unknown, everything is surrounded by water. The landscape is really almost prehistoric in a way. There's like this, this unfamiliarity with the culture. And because it is a place that, I mean, literally when we were filming in Iceland, we were there in November, October, November, and there were 3 hours of sunlight a day. Like it's, there's just this sort of cold aspect to it that I think haunts us even more. Like that sort of, I don't know, when you're like, when you're watching movies about families and everything's warm and the colors are bright and there's like deep reds and oranges and you feel this sort of like sense of safety and then that gets disrupted. It's really jarring. But within the Nordic films specifically that I've seen, especially like Let the Right One In, the original Swedish version, there's a lot of blues. And then when you see the warm tones like reds, they really throw you off. So you get sort of familiar with this cold, internalizing this, this sort of empty, cold space that feels dark just because that is the actual like texture and coloring of the country you're in. And so it's got this darkness just in the surroundings. The surroundings don't even really feel safe when you put them in the noir within those countries. And so then when something happens, it feels even more like uncomfortable because you're just like, everything's cold and now there's nowhere warm to run. And like, everything feels icky. And like, you know, for Shadowtown, there's this one moment where my character's in the shower and something happens and it's cold and she's in the shower because she's cold. And she gets out of the shower and she's scared. And then she's scared and cold in a cold place. It's just like, I think they utilize the actual temperature and feeling of the place that they're in with the color, with the music, with everything that just, it just like affects you differently. At least that's been my experience in watching a lot of the Scandinavian horror that I've sort of had an opportunity to see. But there's a lot of like blue hues and a lot of dark hues. And I find that very interesting.
I'm really glad you brought up Let the Right One In. That's a film that I bring up a lot when I talk about horror or when someone asks me what my favorite film is. I go to that one, and very few guests have heard of it, let alone seen it. But yeah, that's, I always bring it up as when, especially when I talk about Scandinavia, I don't know if you like that film, but that's always been one of my favorites.
You know, it's funny. I've seen both versions too. I remember seeing the Chloe Grace Moretz one, and I think she does a phenomenal job. Very, very fantastic job. But there is something so unsettling about the Scandinavian one. There's just something about it that just like, it sits in you in a way that is just so jarring. Like it's, and I think part of it is the age of the children. And I know Chloe Grace Moretz was young when she did like Let the Right One In, but the girl in the Scandinavian one is so young.
I think they were like 11 or 12 when they shot it, something like that. Have you ever read the original book that it was based off of?
No, I haven't. I should.
It's good. It's good. It's good. It's like, it's weird and creepy, but it's good. Going back to the cold factor, when you're shooting in a region like Scandinavia or a country like Iceland, I'm curious how much the landscape plays a character.
Yeah, I think it really depends on the film. I mean, with Iceland in Shadowtown, we were really focusing on the new development of what Iceland has been experiencing over the last few years, especially since the recession. There's been, you know, a lot of economic trouble in Iceland, a lot of that is because it became a place where everyone wanted to see it, because it is such a phenomenal, I mean, the landscape there is insane. You're driving for 5 minutes and you see completely black beaches with black sand and you can't tell where the water is. You feel like you could drive for years. And then there's like a random thing with a cave and you're just so confused. And then there's like squishy moss everywhere. And then there's trees and it's just like, where am I? It's like you feel like you're on Mars when you're in Iceland. But I think what was really interesting about where we were specifically is that we were focusing on the city core and how different that feels than what you expect Iceland to be. It feels empty, but also too full at the same time. And I think that's really interesting because I know Jan really wanted to tell a story of something that Scandinavian people, specifically Icelanders, are experiencing right now, which is this like overgrowth of downtown to facilitate having spaces for visitors to stay, which is great for the economy. But at the same time, it's sort of creating this inauthenticity within the space, because when you think of Iceland, you don't think of condos, you don't think of big, you know, skyscrapers, you think of small traditional homes, you think of the water, you think of a vast spaces of nothingness, which you see a lot of when you're there. But you think of Icelandic horses and waterfalls, I don't know, but to be able to see Iceland in a way that the Icelanders are seeing it right now in terms of this like vast change into sort of a North American look, I think was something that he really wanted to play with, because it is in and of itself unsettling, like seeing Iceland and not seeing any of the actual landscape of it, except for when I'm running, is interesting, because she's running to a place that is the only home she feels she has, even though she's not from there. Her mother is. So she's experiencing like this one aspect of it that is real, but then also this other aspect that feels incongruous with what she's expecting.
Was there a moment or a scene from the film that you really enjoyed doing?
Yeah, I really enjoyed the, there's two actually that I can really recall. Obviously there's the scene with John. Working with him is always such an incredible moment. The scene with John at the end of the movie, was really beautiful and really wonderful to work on with him. And then there's one moment, in the film. Well, I mean, there's a handful of ones, but there's the moment in the film where I wake up from my sleep on the couch and everything is sort of in chaos around me. And I run into the washroom and I slam the door and I just hide to the best of my ability from myself, from my surroundings. That was a really fascinating scene to film, in part because of the choreography of it, and because of the vulnerability of it. And we were filming in this crazy old home in the middle of nowhere, by like a spot people go to see the Northern Lights, and the house itself felt like it had this personality. And when we were shooting that, there was like a lot of connectivity between the crew and myself, and it was a very small crew, and that was a really remarkable and kind of fun but spooky scene. We all really enjoyed working on that one together.
Now it's Iceland, and I know a popular thing to have in Iceland is puffin. I'm curious as if you've ever tried puffin.
I haven't. I really respect the cuisine of Iceland, but it is not for me. The puffin and the whale are not quite my favorite things. I don't know if I would love them. Maybe I would think they are the best thing on the planet, but I could not bring myself to eat them. I did eat a lot of fish while I was there. I had some chicken, but no puffin.
Yeah. Or they have, what's the other one? The hakarl, the rotten shark, I know is a bit of a delicacy. I don't know if you can call it that. But...
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it a delicacy, but apparently it is one. I just couldn't. I cannot bring myself to do those things, to eat those things. but some people love them. You know, you got to do what you got to do. You're living in Iceland. You don't have a lot of places to grow vegetables.
Well, I suppose if you grow up in that, you know, in like with that lifestyle, then it's, you know, then it's second nature to you, right?
So yeah, exactly.
Well, the film is Shadowtown, and it is out on the 21st, I believe.
Yeah, the 21st.
On VOD and digital. Brittany Bristow, thank you so much for your time this afternoon, this morning, today.
this day of ours.
Yes. I encourage all listeners to go out and see Shadowtown.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
That was my conversation with actress Brittany Bristow. Her new film, Shadowtown, is out on February the 21st on VOD and digital. That does it for me today. Be sure to check out The Feather News and Drink Water. My thanks to Eric McCormick, Ryan Moccasin, and Brittany Bristow. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye for now.